I'd like to welcome you all out tonight. I'm Robert Burns, the chairman of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. If you'd join me in turning your phones off or putting them on vibrate, we could have hopefully a nice short and uninterrupted meeting. Our purpose here tonight is to gather public input on the agenda items that are before us. We'll make recommendations to the Wildlife Board, and then they actually set the policy for wildlife management in Utah. I represent the public at large, and we'll go ahead and go around and have our introductions.
Justin Doling, Regional Supervisor. I'm the Executive Secretary and non-voting member.
R. Jeffrey Hicks, at large.
John Wall from Riverdale, public at large.
Lynn Nelson, elected official.
John Leonard, sportsman.
John Blazard, agriculture.
Craig Van Tassel, sportsman.
Paul Cowley with Forest Service.
And I'd like to recognize two of the members of the Wildlife Board, Ernie Perkins and Bill Fenimore, which they live in the northern region, so they like to attend our Regional Advisory Council meetings. Our procedure tonight, we'll have a presentation from the division, then we'll have questions from the public, questions from the council, then we'll go back to the public for comments. If you wish to comment, please fill out a blue card. They're back there on the table, and I'll just call you up in order. That way we get your name correct on the minutes, and we can have a record of who spoke. After the public comment period, we'll close it off to the public participation. The council will comment, make motions, deliberate on those motions, and then we'll move on to the next agenda item. We don't have any changes to our agenda tonight that's been published previously, so Chair would entertain a motion to approve the agenda for this meeting.
So moved.
Is there a second? Craig. So we have a motion from Lynn Nielsen, a second from Craig Van Tassel to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. All in favor, please raise your hands. Unanimous. You should have all received the minutes I sent out on Monday night. There were some changes in there. Are there any additional amendments to those meeting minutes? Seeing none, Chair would entertain a motion to approve.
I move we approve the minutes as corrected.
Second.
So we have a motion from Paul and a second from John Blazard to approve the minutes of November 7th, 2012. All in favor? It's unanimous. There is no Wildlife Board meeting update, as I noted in my email to you, because they're actually meeting tomorrow on the topics that we met on last. There was a working meeting today where there was some discussion with no action. The board did discuss the big game hunt schedule that had come out previously. They're inclined to put off any changes in moving the season dates around for at least 2 years. Try to let the changes we've made settle out so we see what the impacts are on that. There's a possibility that there'll be changes for youth recruitment where possibly a person could donate a tag to a youth or someone who's terminally ill or ill. But that requires a code change by the legislature, and then there would be a rule change, a rule coming around to allow that. So we might see that in the future. We had a, there was some discussion on standardizing Iraq minutes, which I'll be handling, and you might see some changes in the format of the minutes. We're supposed to have some guidelines in effect already, but we're probably not following them. So you should see some changes there. There was an analysis of the effects of lifetime license holders and dedicated hunters with the new 30-unit deer hunting program. There were only two units that were very affected by how many tags were actually available to the general public, and that should all even out for next year's draw. So because of people dropping out in their third year and having to re-enroll, they won't be guaranteed a tag in those units, and there'll be more that I think the limitation was supposed to be 15% dedicated hunters in any one unit, and there were two that were, one that was very close and one that was higher, but that will change next year. That won't happen again because of the cyclic nature of the dedicated hunter program. So there was an update on wolves. Really, there's no change right now. We don't have any known identified breeding pairs, and there hasn't been any change in the listing. So there were several other discussions, which I haven't made any notes beyond that, but no actions. So, and then I'll try to get once the summary of motions comes out from the Wildlife Board, I'll get that out to you on their actions tomorrow. Paul.
So my question is, with the hesitancy to adjust dates, does that also work as far as the couple of units that we had late hunts proposed on?
This hunt schedule was the proposal that we looked at a couple of years ago. It was mostly informational about swapping the hunts around, because now the legislature's given the Wildlife Board authority to have the deer hunt start before that, I believe, third Saturday in October. It could start as early as the 1st of October. And so that was, if you remember, it was a calendar where the hunts were moved around quite a bit. So it would have a pretty big impact on how people hunt. It could have more opportunity, it could have less, it could put more people in the field at different times. So the general feeling that the Wildlife Board had was that they would like to wait and see what the impacts are, you know, and what the results are of the new 30-unit deer management system. Okay. Any other questions? John.
The units that you said the dedicated hunter numbers were going to be, have to be limited in, do you know what those units were?
Well,
or is that
the, I'm sure you, the Plateau Thousand Lakes was a limited entry unit previously that didn't really qualify as a limited entry unit, and it was changed for this last year to a general unit. So a lot of people thought that they were going to go in there, it would be the first year as a general hunt, and they would score big. Some people did get some nice bucks off there, but it was not the big thing of a first year opening of a unit. So mostly because it wasn't really a trophy limited entry unit to start with. So that's the one that was really, the majority of the tags were taken by dedicated hunters and lifetime license holders, with only a small amount left over for the public in the drawing. But next year, that will drop down below the 15% threshold, guaranteed by how many people drop out of the dedicated hunter program and have to re-enroll their three-year terms up. The other one that had was right near the limit was the Southwest Desert. And it was only 0.6% over the 15% allowed. So all the rest were well below the limitation. And One thing that was noted was the lifetime license holders. They were very, other than the Plateau Thousand Lakes, they were very evenly distributed across the state. They didn't really bunch up in any one unit other than that Plateau Thousand Lakes, because they probably felt that they could score big on a unit that was converting the first year.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none. John, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm John Cabot, non-consumptive.
I did neglect to say, probably because John wasn't here, when you get up to make your comments, if you're representing a group, please state that, and we'll give you 5 minutes for your comments. If you're just representing yourself, we'll give you 3 minutes. And John has a timer here. He'll kind of keep track of you, though. So, I don't expect we're going to ride you too hard, because we're not going to have a lot of comments tonight. So we'll go to the regional update.
Okay, thank you. I'm sure most of you heard by now, but Greg Sheehan was appointed as our new director, and that was effective December 1st. And so we're excited to have him on board as our new director and looking forward to some exciting change in the agency. So stay tuned there. In our law enforcement section, the law enforcement guys are gearing up to conduct these winter range patrols. And if you have any interest at all from the RAC to join one of our officers in the field, please feel free to either contact Scott Davis or Mitch Lane or Keith Fullenkamp. In our wildlife section, the biologists are just finishing up the postseason deer classifications, and they're beginning to work on our mule deer unit management plans. So our mule deer management plans are up for review, and they'll be coming through the RACs. I can't tell you exactly when, but in 2013. a little update on our coyote control program. Currently, we've checked in 2,351 coyotes and paid out $117,550 for those animals. There's a nice little graph that John Shivick's produced that shows the actual activity is starting to increase, and he anticipates the activity will increase over January and February, and then probably tail off a bit.
Is that statewide?
That's statewide. And he, unfortunately, at the time, he didn't have a regional breakout, so I can't tell you how many came from the northern region at this point. In our habitat section, the biologists are finishing up habitat projects. I believe most of the burn rehab work has been completed, and seed has been flown onto the ground, and so things are kind of wrapping up there. And this is the time of year when they sit down and start to enter projects into the database. So they're busily entering projects for consideration for funding next year. For our outreach section, Hardware Ranch will have its Elk Festival Saturday, December 15th. It's kind of the grand opening for the sleigh season there at Hardware. So if you've got the 15th open and would like to go up and see what's going on at Hardware, I encourage you to do that. There'll be a lot of activities up there in addition to sleigh rides, a lot of kid activities. So if you've got some young kids or grandkids, you want to get up and get out and get close and personal with elk, I'd encourage you to go up on the 15th of December. In our aquatic section, the biologists are basically wrapping up the field season, and so they'll be in writing reports and summarizing field data, planning for spring projects. They tell me that whitefish are starting to run at Bear Lake, so if you like to go up and fish for whitefish, it's a good time to start thinking about that. And then they tell me that there is some ice fishing currently along the Mirror Lake Highway, but conditions right now warrant caution, I'll put it that way. So anyway, that completes my regional update, unless there's any questions.
Thank you, Justin. We'll now go to the Falconry Guidebook and Rule with Jim Parrish.
Thank you.
She's feeding the mommy down there, Mike.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the RAC, division staff, members of the public, I'm both a speaker for both topics tonight, so we have really two action items for you. The first one is the annual review of R-657-20. It's the rule that regulates falconry in Utah. And I just need to hit this up or down, right, to make us go, which I'm doing. There we go. Just slow, it's like me. So. Thank you. We have coordinated with the falconers on the recommendations that we're presenting. These are mainly editorial. The regular five-year review is not up for a few more years yet. And we directed them to the website where there's a copy of the rule as you received in your packets and have sent letters out to them as well. Whoops. There we go. Okay. Your red line copy, which doesn't show all the red, thank goodness, but looks very busy, but they're really not that extensive. During the guidebook prep, the first guidebook that we've ever done for falconry, some conflicts and some errors came up. There were some recommendations that some sections be combined, which we've done. Some language needed to be clarified, which we've done. And some edits to remove some errors, and also some edits for at least one compliance issue. And I'll go through those as we go through the presentation here. The first one's on minimum age. There was still a conflict in the rule from our previous rounds with the rule. The service lowered the minimum age for practice of falconry from 14 to 12. That was only reflected in part of the rule. So in the current copy that you have in front of you in sections 3, 9, and 25, that's now been clarified to show the 12-year-old minimum age requirement. Well, get it together here in a minute. There's language in the current rule about a non-resident COR. Fact of the matter is we do not issue a COR to non-residents. So we've taken that, we've clarified that and taken that language out and corrected it. If an individual moves here that's a falconer in another state and they want to establish residency in Utah, we have provisions for that. But we don't issue a COR to a non-resident to come here and practice falconry. We honor the falconry permit that they have from their home state. So we've clarified that in the copy that's before you. Facilities inspections. The current rule instructs individuals to schedule a facilities inspection by either mailing or emailing a request to their respective division regional office. We've corrected that because the practice really is to make a phone call for individuals to call in and schedule a time with individuals in the region, the COs in the region, to go out and do the inspections. And then there's also one clarification that'll probably come up here a little later on some wording that was off in the facilities inspection section there in section 6. So we're recommending changing that to reflect the procedure of the individuals just calling in to schedule their inspections. Probably the one that has the most weighty change or clarification is with the sponsor program. In the current rule, the existing rule, the sponsor program is, or the sponsor requirement is for an apprentice class or entry class falconer. But it's all part of the apprentice class section in the current rule. And with the minimum age stipulation changing and some other things that Marty Bushman actually brought to our attention, we're looking for ways to improve the sponsor program overall. And we just felt like that should be its own standalone section. So it's now section 10 in the rule. And I'll just read this to you so it's in the record. And it states that any person sponsoring an apprentice under the age of 18, other than the minor's parent or legal guardian, must be approved in writing by the minor's parent or legal guardian and submitted to the division before being designated as the minor sponsor. We want to avoid making that more complicated than it has to be, but individuals working with minors, we felt like this would clarify that, and that's reflected in the changes that we're recommending as well. Reporting requirements. Essentially, all the activities that are conducted, that falconers conduct with their birds, have to be reported to the division. The current rule has reporting requirements scattered throughout the rule and in several sections. We recommend adding a new section, section 21, that places all of the reporting requirements in one location. It felt like that would just be more clear for anyone reading the rule and going through it. Banding requirements are somewhat similar. There's been some confusion with the types of bands required. There's already a separate section in the rule for that, but we have some clarification on the language regarding the banding requirements. And the one compliance issue that I mentioned before, that's in section 22 on unintentional take. In the old rule, the falconer had 5 days to report an unintentional take to the division. It was pointed out to us that that was out of compliance with the fur bearer rule, which states that has to be done within 48 hours. And so we're changing the falconry rule to reflect the 48 hours to be in compliance with the fur bearer rule, and that's in section 22. Otherwise, we tried to consolidate things and do some editorial work on the rule to make it more reader-friendly. Basically, that's all I have. So any questions on the falconry rule?
Do we have any questions from the public on the presentation? Seeing, we'll go to the council. Jeffrey.
Probably a silly question, but...
No such thing.
So what is the most... I mean, what is an unintentional take?
I got that last night, too.
Okay. So.
The example I gave last night, let's say a falconer was out hawking pheasants, and a pheasant gets up, but a rail or a water bird gets up at the same time or nearby, and the falcon decides, I like the rail, and peels off and takes the rail. So that's an unintentional take. You intend for the bird to take a certain quarry, but once they get in the air, they make up their mind sometimes of what they want to do. And so that would cover the individual. The individual wouldn't be cited, but they'd need to report that if the bird actually took a protected wildlife in that kind of situation. So,
can I follow up?
Is that clear for you?
I'll make it fast because I know this is supposed to be a fast meeting. But so I'm just curious to see. I just think this is really interesting to me, so I just want to learn a little bit more. But so let's say a snowy plover flies up and it takes a snowy plover. And then
Why
so they
you
call in.
Snowy plover? No, go ahead, I'm
sorry. So the falconer calls in and says, oh, my bird caught a snowy plover. Obviously, you wouldn't hold a guy responsible for that, I assume.
No,
even though
we wouldn't.
Okay.
And most likely, that's a good example, but. Most birds would take off with a snowy plover and be over the hill, and you probably wouldn't even know what they took. They'd eat it because they're pretty small, and they could haul it off. But anyway, so.
Yeah, I was just seeing if there's any reason in the world why they wouldn't want to report their unintentional take.
Well, yeah, we encourage them to do that because we're not going to cite them for that. So they pretty well know that, so I hope. So yeah, John?
Sorry.
Got a question.
Yeah, go ahead. Jim, I was just reading through the rule change in terms of the banding requirements, and it mentions that you've taken out the U.S. Fish and Wildlife part, but you leave in the service leg band. And I'm wondering is what service band that is, and how does someone get those?
There's two sections on that. In section two, there's a definitions where we define those there. But the service issues two bands, one for a wild-caught bird and one for a captive-bred bird. And those are the two bands, essentially, that they're required to use.
And they get them through the division office?
Through the division office, yeah.
And do they have to pay for those, or are they free?
No, they don't have to pay for them.
Any additional questions? Seeing none, we'll go to public comment. Christopher Wall?
First off, thanks for allowing us to come. Is this one? Sorry, I'm kind of short. Appreciate our time here. Our purpose in representing our group here, I'm with the Utah Falconers Association. Our purpose here is to show our support for the changes that have been made. We have worked in close collaboration with Jim and his team, and most of the input in here is very much what we've been looking for as a group. And so we're here to show our support and approval for the changes. If there's any questions that we can answer, let us know. But once again, thanks for Jim and Anita and those that you've had working on this. And we have had time to review this in great detail. Jim's been gracious enough to involve us in the process, and we don't have any concerns with this.
Thank you. I don't have any additional blue cards. Is there anyone from the public who'd like to comment? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Jim, I would like to congratulate you on how much you seem to have struck out of the rule, which simplicity is always better in my, as long as it meets the requirements and gets past Marty and you manage to get rid of that much, I would commend you. So.
Well, I appreciate that. It's not a Jim-only effort. Anita helps a lot, and I run it by as many people as I can. I coordinate with the Falconers as much as we can, and I want to produce a good program for us. We changed from service, Fish and Wildlife Service, kind of a two-permit system a few years ago, and we're still adjusting to ourselves being in control. But I think we're getting there. I think we're going to have a good program for everybody that wants to practice falconry. So.
Good. Thank you. Any additional comments from the council? John Leonard.
Yeah, Jim, I'm just wondering how popular it is in the state, and is it something that's growing?
The sport overall?
Yes.
We've got a little under 200 registered falconers now. Most of those are along the Wasatch Front. We have some in every region. But central and northern regions and northeast, those are kind of the top three areas where guys practice the sport. But we've got just a little under 200 this year. We've been up to 250, but it kind of goes up and down. So it's around 2 to 250 year in, year out.
Thank you.
Additional comments? Paul.
Just to note that there are a couple of corrections in there as we've identified. I pointed one of those out to Jim tonight. But
anything specific you'd like to note?
It was just a correction in the document where it's oversighted on taking conservation, national species of conservation concern. We had one area where we had general class being allowed to take those, and it just had missed a knot. They're not allowed to take those at any class.
There's some a typo there, and then another one on facilities where, which the Falconers pointed out to us earlier today, in fact, on facilities inspections when someone increases the number of birds or changes address. They do need to get a new facilities inspection when they change address, but not always when they get another bird. We needed to clean up that language a little bit. So I'm aware of that, and we're going to get to that.
Okay,
so.
And would you consider including that in your presentation for our motion if we make as presented?
Yes.
Okay, and then,
fine.
Then yeah. You'll have that changed before you get to the Wildlife Board.
Oh, meeting. Yeah. So.
John Blazer.
Yeah. I was just wondering what hacking, when it says that they're at hacking, what does that mean?
Well, it's not done as much as it used to be. It refers to a practice that really began in the old world. If you take a bird, there's several ways to do it, but I guess the basic way is if you take a bird from the nest, a young bird, first time it's ever seen the world, hatched out this past spring, and take that bird for falconry. Sometimes they can get imprinted or they're not quite ready to, depends on the age you take them, and then we do have stips on that. But there's one practice where you can take the bird out to an area. It's a little bit difficult to do in today's world, but maybe set up a tower or something, and that becomes their home. You feed them every day, but they're free to go and come as they please. And typically, if they all of a sudden don't show, they start not showing up for feeding, then you trap them back, and they're closer to a wild bird than they would have been if you just kept them and just kept them and raised them as from a nestling on up. And sometimes they get imprinted, and they can be kind of obnoxious when they're fully imprinted. But it's a way to add a little wildness to a bird that's taken out of a nest. I guess that's the best way to put it. And they're usually stronger flyers and much better hunters when you do that sometimes. But it's not always feasible in today's world. Just there's not any large areas that are where you'd feel good about letting your bird hang out like that. So that I cover it fairly good. So, okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. You can use it for, if you need to make some changes in behavior somewhat of some, like when they're imprinted, they'll what's called scream. They'll just call all the time when you're around. They essentially substitute you as a sib or a parent. And that's a little hard to hunt with when you got the bird screaming the whole time. So if you want that behavior perhaps out, you can hack them out for a while, and sometimes it'll take that away. So.
Shot collars don't work.
Shot collars don't work, and they don't make them that small.
Okay. I'm learning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any additional comments and or motions from the council?
I'd move that we approve this rule as presented.
Second.
We have a motion from Paul and a second from John Leonard to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the Falconry Guidebook and Rule R657-20 as presented. Acceptable, Paul?
Correct.
Okay. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand. It's unanimous.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Jim.
Okay. Thank you. The second action item for you tonight is R657-12 on special season extension for disabled persons. I'm kind of pinch hitting for Kenny Johnson tonight, and he's given me some notes, so I hope I cover it well for you. In Section 7, they're recommending replacing some obsolete language in the sections that are referenced there, and I think all of this should be in your packets. They're proposing to have the extended turkey season to be 7 days prior to the limited entry hunt date that's published in the guidebook, and that would ensure a full weekend with less pressure, which is the intent of the season extensions to start with. So, and that's the first one. In Section 8 of the rule, crossbows and draw locks for qualifying disabilities, they propose adding carp to the list of species approved for crossbow take, people with disabilities only, and propose adding fishing as a recognized season. And the crossbows must have a reel with line capable of tethering the bolt to restrict flight distance and a positive safety mechanism. And he has a note here, crossbows are only for people with disabilities for carp. They must have permanent qualifying upper extremity disability that makes it so they cannot use conventional archery equipment. So, and then the last one, Section 10, on fishing license for veterans with disabilities. I understand there was a promise to the board to evaluate this after 1 year, which we're now in that category. Currently, veterans with 40% or higher disability rating get a $5 discount on season fishing license. Since 2011, they've had 93 veterans that have purchased one of these discount licenses, and so they've determined that the impact is not significant either to the resource or to revenue, And so the proposal is to lower the current service-connected disability rating from 40% to 20%. And the extra note he's given me here, at 40% disability rating, okay, 93% participants, at 20%, the anticipated impact is 300 to 400 additional participants. And they would be willing to consider more of a discount in the future. And I believe that's it, and I'll do the best to try to answer questions if you have any.
Do we have any questions from the public on this presentation? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. The 93 individuals, was that just fishing, or was that the total for the program?
That's one where we maybe need to make the phone call. I believe it. Pardon? Thank you, Ernie.
I'm Ernie Perkins, Wildlife Board, and I attended those meetings with the veterans and have worked on this for several years, so I can answer some questions. 93 is the number of disabled veterans with that applied for the reduced price license.
On fishing?
On fishing only. That's okay. The only reduced price license available to veterans at okay. present time.
Ernie or Jim,
mm-hmm.
do you know what the total participation in the disabled program is?
Boy, I'm going from memory right now. I believe there's something on the order of 15,000 disabled veterans in Utah. But that's an approximate number.
I mean, people participating in you know, bow hunting for fish or anything like that are are season extensions.
No, okay. I don't think there's right. any data to indicate veteran status on hunting or fishing license purchases. So okay. we probably got, I don't know, 5,000 okay. disabled veterans that do hunting or fishing in Utah.
Okay.
I believe Kenny did get a question last night in Central Region along the same lines. And if I remember right, we don't have an exact number. It's apparently a little hard to get a handle on that. But I don't think there is an exact number. But as Ernie mentioned, that's probably a good ballpark of how many we have. So.
Okay. Other questions from the council?
The intent on the way the division's been working this with the concurrence of the veterans group is to they'd like to afford a reasonably good discount to disabled veterans. On the other hand, since we're funded out of license sales, we can't afford to give away the whole bank without knowing how large the clientele pot is going to be. So the division has taken the approach of easing into it, and we'll do things a step at a time. And if step two works nice, then, as Jimmy indicated, perhaps the next step is to increase the size of the discount that's offered to.
And when in doubt, read the directions right. He does have one note on some stats that we approve 300 to 400 annually for all species. There's an estimate of about 15 to 30 annually for turkey, and we deny about 500 annually.
And those are probably season extensions.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But now that's not disabled veterans.
That's all disabled people applying for. Yeah.
But that's kind of what my first question was, or my question about how many people participate in the total program. So, okay. Any additional questions from the council? John Cavett.
So, Jim, fishing license reductions are the only reduced permit fee that's allowed for. Is that correct for disabled?
I believe that's correct, yeah.
Okay, we'll go to comments. We don't have any blue cards from the public. Does anyone wish to comment on this topic? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. John Blazard.
I just had a comment on the crossbow issue. That better? Better. I had both my shoulders tore up, and so I applied for a Corps to do the crossbow thing. But it seems to me like it became really cumbersome for me because I had to re-up it every year. And it seems to me like if you qualified for the Corps and could do that, it would be, and I had to go to the division office every time to to do that, and it would be a lot easier if you could just do that online or over the phone as you're applying for your hunting licenses or doing, rather than have to apply in person, you know, show up in person with my certificate every year in order to get my hunting license. And then I had my other shoulder tore up, and so I didn't hunt for 1 year. And so then that just made everything go away, and I had to start over again.
Mm-hmm. Of course, this is a little bit out of my area, but I'm just a fair guess is they would need to have some way to document that you even qualify for the reduced license. So if your certificate or, I mean, I don't know if guys get doctors, some guys maybe could pay doctors. I believe it's a Class B misdemeanor. If you enter into fraud on these kinds of things. So somehow, and I'll just mention all these things to Kenny and to the licensing section, if they had a way where you could have your certificate read to read it in with your online application, then perhaps it's doable. But I think they would still have to have some way to verify that you indeed qualify for the reduced license.
You had to do that with the doctor before you got the original COR.
Right.
And so it seems like once you have that number, it would be so much easier for an applicant to be able to just give that number with when he was receiving the license.
John, was it a single-year COR or was it a multi-year COR?
It was multiple.
So
probably forever, I'm afraid. I assume that the doctor at the time could say, you know, this is a temporary thing or it's a lifetime thing. Or.
Mm-hmm. Should be able to, yeah. I would guess, yeah.
It would just make it a lot easier for the public to be able to do that online when they're applying for their permit if they could, rather than have to feel, you know, if I lived across the road from the division office, it wouldn't be too bad. But.
Right. I'll pass it on.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And it would have to be, given the conditions we have now, you'd have to get a season extension or a weapon variance after you knew you had a permit. Because at times you might not get a permit.
I didn't know anything about a season extension. I was just getting the crossbow permit so I could hunt as a dedicated hunter.
Yeah, and I think the point is it'd be helpful to be able to just do that all once rather than continuously having to
have
provide
to do
documentation.
Every year and have to make the trip to Salt Lake every year and do all those things.
Seems like if it was just joining the dialogue here, if it was a permanent disability, something ought to be able to make that more user-friendly, if you will.
Yeah.
If it's a short-term kind of thing, then you could
then
be better
to, then
anytime.
It needs to be year by year.
Right.
Yes.
Jeffrey.
Okay, one more question. Probably my last one for the night. Under crossbows and draw locks, under 12.8, when you first started discussing it, you mentioned carp. And I was wondering, a couple of rack meetings ago, we talked about making it easier for archers to take carp and dispose of carp and make the whole process easier. And it appeared, maybe I'm mistaken, but so we've added carp to the list of things, waterfowl, small game, and basically other protected wildlife. Is carp still considered protected wildlife? And why did you add carp in, is all I'm wondering.
Wow, that's a good one. I don't know if carp are protected wildlife. I don't know. I know some of the... There is a listing of unprotected wildlife in rule, and in code, rather, and I don't believe CARP's on there. Board members, would you know if CARP is on the unprotected list? I don't think it is.
Mike Fox spoke about having legislation in this coming session about wasting wildlife, and CARP was one of the species you were talking about getting added to the list so someone would be accused of wasting wildlife.
Right. I believe it is protected because there's been some question on, I hope I'm not stepping out of too far out of what I should, but there have been some discussions on control, other types of control for carp to benefit sport fish. And so maybe I just better shut up and let Ernie take it from here. So I think it is protected, though. I believe it is still listed as protected.
I believe that's correct. I believe it is protected wildlife. However, I believe I asked Kenny Johnson about a month ago this exact same question, and I believe the answer is that notice at the end of that 12-8, it says, or any weapon hunting seasons as provided during the applicable proclamations of the Wildlife Board. And therefore, if the proclamation says that we can take carp, disabled people can take carp, that fills the requirement. So it doesn't need to be, everything doesn't need to be added to the list. So, and that had been through the legal review and all the rest. So I think that's the answer.
And, does that cover it?
Yeah, I'm just wanting to just see why the carp was added there, and with the understanding that I know they're working on other issues for carp on for archery.
And I believe carp is protected, otherwise it wouldn't be a wasting wildlife issue for the disposal of carp without utilizing it. So it is probably protected. Yeah.
Gentleman here is identifying that there's grass carp and common carp, and grass carp are protected in all kinds of ways, so there would need to be a clarification on that.
Okay. And the clarification for, just so I know what to tell. Okay.
Jim, can I provide some clarification?
Yes, sir. Please do.
My memory serves, carp are the only species that can be harvested with bow and arrow. And therefore, I think the crossbow variance would allow a disabled person to participate in that same sport.
Okay.
And then the wasting portion of the issue will be dealt with through a bill that the division is asking a representative to sponsor through the legislature this coming fall. And I agree with Ernie. Carp are considered protected wildlife. There's very few species that are not considered protected wildlife.
Thank you.
Cowbirds.
Any additional comments from the council? Chair would consider a motion if someone would care to make one. John.
I make a motion that we accept the division's recommendation to the Wildlife Board.
Sir, I second it. I'll do it.
Lynn, was that you? Okay. We have a motion from John Wall and a second from Lynn Nielsen to recommend the Wildlife approve R657-12 hunting and fishing accommodations for people with disabilities as presented. Is that acceptable, John?
Yeah.
Okay. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. Please raise your hands if you're in favor. It's unanimous. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim. Now, this will be the, if you'd care to adjourn, this will be the shortest meeting we've ever had. So,
you want to wait a while?
No.
I move we adjourn.
Okay. Second. Thank you very much. And thank you for coming.